So we're in Exodus 16, about verse 22. To kind of recap how we have gotten to where we are, Exodus is the book of the Jewish nation's exit from Egypt, hence the name Exodus. It's their leaving of Egypt. And we've seen them leave at this point, the parting of the Red Sea, them traveling through on dry ground, and the Pharaoh's army being destroyed in that water as it receded back to its original condition. Now we're in that section of Exodus that deals primarily with the kind of character issues that are left. So you think the hard part is getting out, right? You'd think, okay, they've been slaves for all these hundreds of years. The hard part is going to be getting out of the clutches of Pharaoh and that circumstance of slavery. Turns out that was the easy part. The hard part is removing their worldly and idolatrous attitudes. Turns out so much in life is that way, right? The physical part's easy, but the spiritual part is what is hard. And as we're here dealing with them out in the wilderness, that's what God is doing. It's character building. And 1 Corinthians chapter 10, which lays out a lot of the events of Exodus, says that all of these things were given to us as examples. So we're to look at these things that they went through and the way that they acted during those things and take those to heart for ourselves, because the character of man is no different today than it was then. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. Their tendency to grumble and be faithless is the same as our tendencies. And so Exodus is taking us through that particular group of people and how they reacted to the tests placed before them, how God desired for them to pass those tests and to grow stronger and more faithful. But ultimately, what we'll find, unfortunately, is that that first generation will not pass the test. They will not be as God intended, and it will be an entire another generation later before God is able to use the people to go and conquer the land. So chapter 16 will take us through, and we look at the giving of the manna. This is snow, not manna. I don't have any pictures of manna, but it is described as like frost on the ground. It tasted sweet, like coriander, being like coriander seeds, being small, like that. So kind of the snow is kind of, you know, at least I envision it in my head, whether that's accurate or not. Well, the answer is it's not accurate, I can guarantee you, but it's the best I've got. But God had laid out for them that every morning they were going to go out and he would produce this manna that they could then cook with and make into a bread or a food source for them each and every day. And there was one simple rule. You gather one day's worth every day except for Friday, in which case on Friday you gather 2 days worth, because Saturday, the Sabbath, you're not going to do any work, you're not going to do any gathering, so you're going to gather 2 days worth on Friday so you have enough for then. And in Exodus 16 he says, I did this so that I could test them. Now when God gives us a test, his desire is to teach us something that will make us better. God doesn't want you to fail. That's not his goal. His goal was that he would have them to walk in his instruction and see the kind of people they would be. In John chapter 6, we are told that there's a comparison in the New Testament. They were given this manna from heaven that would just provide for all of their physical needs. In John 6, Jesus says, I am the true bread of heaven. I'm the thing that God sent down from heaven in order to provide for you. And last week we focused a little bit on that fact that if they were supposed to take the manna every day, how much should we be ingesting Jesus' words? How often? Should be a daily thing, right? It should be part of who we are and the bread of life. You don't eat one meal and then call it good. So from there we move to chapter 16 down to verse 22. And it says, on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, and then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So they're told, take 2 days worth on that Friday. And so they're introduced to this idea of the Sabbath. Now, it won't be long from now that the Sabbath is put down as one of the, what is often referred to as the Ten Commandments. It's one of the basic tenets of being a Jew, is that you're going to take Saturday, the Sabbath, off. Now, Sabbath just means a rest. And in fact, under the Jewish law, there are other Sabbath days as well. Whenever there are feasts and festivals, those also would be mentioned as a rest day. But the regular weekly observance Sabbath was what they were supposed to do. And then in verse 27, we find out it doesn't take too long for them to not do as they ought to. It says it came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. So God tells them a very simple instruction. Gather 6 days. On the sixth day, you double it. And do they follow it? No. Even in simple instructions, they're testing God's patience. And it is a good example of the simple idea of the authority of God. If God asks us to do something simple, we don't go, "Well, that's such a silly little thing. That's not important." It's a very simple instruction. 6 days, yes. 1 day, no. But how big of a deal was it to God? It's a big deal. If God says it, he means it, and we just simply go with that. And so, verse 31, we're given this description. It says the house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. So it was a good tasting thing. I always think that's interesting that, you know, here you have God, he could have made it taste like whatever, but he gave it a pleasant taste. And then they are to keep an omer full of it in the ark as a reminder throughout generations. Now, what's interesting about that is typically when you gather manna, what happens the next morning? It goes bad. It's got worms, right? Now, on the sixth day, when you gathered it and you kept it overnight, it would be okay, right? So it would last 2 days. That's a very scientific thing, isn't it? Right? Every morning it gets worms in it, but Sabbath morning. That's not science, is it? That's a miraculous event. God miraculously created it, and then he's miraculously having it last 2 days this time instead of one. Now, this manna, this jar of manna that's going to go in the ark, how long is it supposed to last? Essentially indefinitely, right? That too would have been a miraculous thing. So we're seeing God providing for them in a way that requires them to trust not their own personal logic, but his words. And that's what faith is when we have a contradiction in our mind between what we think is the right thing to do or how things ought to work and what God says. Faith is hearing what he says and then acting upon it. And so that's the simple, basic idea that he's trying to teach them out here in the wilderness. Which brings us to chapter 17. So now we've had the food issue, and now in chapter 17 we're going to have a water issue. So chapter 17 says, all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Now, in the past they had water, but it was available, but what was the problem with the water in the past? One other occasion we had, what was wrong with it? It's bitter. So they had water, but it was bitter. Now they don't have any water. And it says, therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." So is it a legitimate need that they have? Do you need water? They needed it too. The need's legitimate. The process by which they're seeking to fill that need is where the problem comes in. Right? It's okay to say, "We need water. Lord, please provide." It's wrong to go to Moses, who we've already found out, when they quarrel with Moses, it's the same as, God has already said, same as quarreling with who? Same as quarreling with God, right? Because Moses is God's representative in this case. And so it's not okay to go to Moses and say, "Why'd you bring us out here to die for lack of water?" And so verse 5, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So here's the interesting thing. This event is referred to in the 95th Psalm, where they tested the Lord. And that language is used here in Exodus 17. They say, you test the Lord because they test the Lord. And what did they say right there at the end of verse 7? They test the Lord by saying what? You're not going to find out there. That's Psalm 95. Exodus 17, down at the end of verse 7, what did they say? Is the Lord among us or not? That's the question. Is God really with us? Now, had they been given evidence that God was with them? In fact, did they have evidence that at any moment they could look at that would tell them God was with them? What was the ever-present evidence? Pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, right? If you had a giant column of torch every night, it'd be a pretty good reminder. So they had it, and yet they're still asking the question. Psalm 95 says, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. That's what it means to test God. They asked for more proof, even though they had already seen his work. Think in your New Testament, is there ever a time where somebody asked Jesus for more proof, even though they'd already seen his work? What did they do? What did they request? Sign from heaven, that's right. Show us another sign. And in fact, I think when they say a sign from heaven, they're asking for a particular type of sign. They say, we want a sign that comes directly from heaven, not one of these, you know, you touch a leper and heal him. We want to see a direct sign. And Jesus does actually say you will get a sign from heaven. What was the sign from heaven that they were going to get? Sign of Jonah, that's right. You're going to get an empty tomb at the end of 3 days, just like Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and then was released. And so that would be the only sign they get. But he refused to offer them any other sign because they were testing him. Not because they hadn't seen evidence, but because there is this voracious appetite for more, more, more. It's never enough. It's not a lack of evidence, but it's a lack of faith, even though evidence had been provided. And so he says, for 40 years, I loathed that generation. And said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore, I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And so, Psalm 95 tells us how God felt during this time. As they were constantly saying, what about this? And you forgot to give us this. And we need more of this. What was God's attitude? It says, I loathe that generation. It was not enjoyable for him. And you know, that's one of the things that we don't always think about, is that here we have Moses, and we know Moses isn't happy, right? Moses is not enjoying his time as leader of the Israelite people. But how does God feel? He loathed it too. It was unenjoyable for him. The New Testament tells us that when you and I sin, we grieve the Holy Spirit. We bring him sorrow. And so too, Psalm 95, which is talking about these events here in Exodus 17. So stick with me. Exodus 17, which is talked about in Psalm 95, is quoted in Hebrews 7. And in Hebrews chapter 7, we're told, do not have an unbelieving heart like them. Because if God loathed that, how do you think he's going to feel when we reject greater proof that we have in Christ? So, from there, they are provided with the water. He strikes the rock. And they're provided with water, but the people have not changed their hearts. Anybody have any comments or questions before we move forward in Exodus there? Okay. It's Hebrews 3:7, not Hebrews 7:3. Yeah, I had it backwards. So this is a picture. Oh, let's not deal with that yet. I'll blank it for the moment. One other event before we go to the judgment seat there, which will show up in chapter 18. Chapter 17, we have this one single event where Amalek came and he fought against Israel at Rephidim. So here they are out there at Rephidim. It's before they've come to Mount Sinai. They're still wandering around. And Amalek And what when you have Amalek, what's the nation going to be called? The Amalekites, right? So Amalek is going to come out and fight against them, and God will defend them. And it says in verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hands down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set, so Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now, we see this quite a lot in the Old Testament, where you have these miracles done in an odd fashion. I call this an odd miracle. I guess all miracles are odd in one way, but this one is odd in the particular fact of the success of the battle is dependent upon what? What is the factor that will change whether they win or lose? Moses' arms. Does that make any sense? There's no logic to that whatsoever, right? Moses isn't even out there fighting. He's up on a mountaintop overlooking the battle. Joshua is down there actually fighting the battle. And the success of the battle is, it's like his arms are the decibel meter in the in CenturyLink field, right? You know, it's like if they're up, we're winning. If they're down, we're losing. And as to why God particularly chose that, I don't know. You certainly could guess a lot of different things, but this is what I do know. When you look at that event, you are not able to walk away saying, "We won because Joshua was such a great strategist." Right? Because it's affected by this motion of the hands that is an illogical reason for them to win or lose. They're not winning because they had the better army, Joshua was a better battle strategist, or any of those things. They're winning purely because they did what God said. God tells Moses, "Go up on the mountaintop, hold your arms up. And when you win, arms up, we win. If you put your arms down," which they do, they start to get heavy. And so Moses enlists help, and they hold his arms up. And all that you learn from that is, when we do what God says, we get victory. What's the one thing that the Israelites need to really, really embed in their hearts? If we do what God says, we'll have victory. Now, what I think is fascinating here is, the guy who leads the charge is Joshua. Joshua is a young man at this point, but eventually Joshua is going to lead the entire nation, the next generation, and he's going to lead them because when he was sent as a spy in the land, what did he say and only one other guy say? He and Caleb say. Yeah, go for it, right? He said, "We can do it." You wonder how much events like this shaped the mind of Joshua. Right? Joshua saw these things happen, and instead of asking for more signs, he let those signs affect his heart so that he trusted God. There was a guy who went to battle and knew it wasn't his battle strategy, but was instead that the hand of the Lord was with him. So, verse 14, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, so that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven.'" Now, this event where he's going to blot out the memory of Amalek, that is, get rid of the Amalekites, this is like that's not going to happen for a while. In fact, it's not going to happen for roughly 400 years when King Saul becomes king. And then God will say it's time to get rid of the Amalekites. But when God says, "I will blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven," what do you know is going to happen? It'll happen, right? It's going to occur. The when is up to God, but it will absolutely happen. By the way, verse 14 here where he says, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua." This is one of the verses that people will go to say that it's quite possible that Moses, in the process of writing the first five books of the Bible, that Joshua was his right-hand man in that process. And just like Paul would dictate letters to people, It's quite possible that Moses was doing the same thing to Joshua, so that Joshua was actually the guy penning it. Do we know for sure? No, but that's one of those verses that people will go to. Regardless of it, whether Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible or Joshua was the actual pen holding the pen, doesn't really matter. Reciting those things to Joshua will be valuable, because who's Joshua eventually going to be? He's going to be the guy that takes over for Moses, right? He'll take over after Moses is gone. So that moves us to chapter 18. Any comments or questions before I move forward? Okay, so in chapter 18, Moses is going to meet back up with his father-in-law, Jethro. Now, in chapter 18, Jethro, we're introduced to Jethro again, and it says he's the priest, Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he had sent her away, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for Moses said, I am a sojourner in a foreign land, and the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro is reunited, as well as Moses, with his wife and children. He had sent them away. It does not tell us the specifics of why they were sent away, but they're all reunited at this point. And Jethro is referred to as a priest of Midian. Now, we talked about this a little bit before, but just as a reminder, is Jethro a Jew or a Gentile? He's a Gentile. And yet, his language as a priest of Midian will always be, he'll talk about Jehovah. And in fact, he'll even give Moses some advice here about the best way to handle judgments in the nation and following the laws that God gives them. It is one of those few windows that we get in the Old Testament to see that even though the Old Testament is really about God building and using the Jewish nation to bring in the Christ, that's why that history is told, it doesn't mean that there aren't people outside of that history that God was working with and doing and caring about. It's not like while God worked with the Jewish nation, he stopped caring about every other human being on the planet. And we've seen a couple of examples of that, of where there were people who were serving God but not Jewish. So Jethro seems to be pointing to another example of that. But once again, we follow this not because the Jews are the only people that God cared about. That's what the Jews wanted to think, right? That was their twisted view on it, is, hey, God only cares about us. They were wrong, right? What was the value of the Jewish nation? There's one really important thing that you and I and every human being should care about with the Jewish nation. It's Jesus, bringing in the Christ, right? So that all mankind would be blessed. So Jethro comes back into the scene. You move down to verse 9, and it says, Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. And so Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. So we see Jethro as being a righteous man who is in the service of God and recognizes how great the one true God is. The other thing that Jethro is going to introduce is an answer to a problem. Now, what I have up here is a picture from Tel Dan. It's the city of Dan. You can go into Israel, and you can see this particular location now. And this right here is a pedestal at which a seat would sit, a judgment seat. And there's a, right along the edge here, there's a bench where other people would sit. And it's in the gates of a city. And so when you go into a city, there was a place where the elders of the city would sit and handle any sort of judgment affairs for the people of the city. So, you know, you have two people and they're arguing over a piece of land, or there's a disagreement over possessions or a trade deal or something more serious, such as murder charges or theft or things of that nature. Those all had to be handled by a court system of sorts. Well, that court system were the elders who would sit in the gate. And that was how the Jews handled it, was there were older men, wiser men, who understood God's laws, who would then take those, their understanding and maturity and wisdom, and use that to apply to specific court cases as to how it would be handled. Well, where did that all begin? That idea that you would have elders in every city who would serve as judges over groups of people. Well, it all began here in chapter 18. Because what Jethro sees when the Israelite nation comes out of Egypt and they've made it all the way through the Red Sea and they make it all the way here to where Jethro is, it says that verse 15, back up just a little bit. Verse 13, it says, it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as a judge for the people? And all the people stand about you from morning until evening. Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his law. So he just lays out. He says, well, I do it because they need answers, and they come to me to inquire of God. Well, Jethro tells them that there is a better solution. He says, the thing that you're doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I'll give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God, and then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. And furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. Interesting thing is, Jethro gives this advice, and tied into that advice are a couple of different details. One is, there's just the practical side of Moses, you can't keep doing this. The nation at this point is counted in the millions. Can you imagine one man handling every court case for millions of people? It's just insanity. There's no way that that's going to work, just from a logistical standpoint. So he lays out what seems a logical plan, but then the other piece of it is if you look down in verse 23, he says, if you do this thing and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure. Jethro says, this is my advice, but he says, he also includes in that advice, if you do this, and what? And God so commands you. So Jethro gives advice, but if the advice is in contradiction of what God tells Moses. In other words, Jethro has this idea. Moses goes back to God and says, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And God says, no. Who do you listen to, Jethro or God? You listen to God. That's what Jethro said. Good advice, right? So I have an expediency in mind, a way that will aid you, but not if it contradicts God. Now, let's make an application to us real quick. Do we ever have expediencies to do things where we're trying to find a wise and convenient way to get something done? Sure. Nothing wrong with that. We used to use the songbooks for our songs, but now what do we use most of the time for songs? Most of the time it's on the PowerPoint up there because we thought that would be a good idea. Now, that's perfectly great. That's just us being wise, saying, you know what, it'd be easier if we just, instead of everybody having to flip their books open, we just blew it up there and put it up there, and then we can all just sing. And it has no contradiction whatsoever to God's laws, because God tells us to sing and make melody in our hearts with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So where if we look at a book for the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, or we look up at a PowerPoint, any difference there in terms of God's command? He didn't tell us where to look. He just said it has to be psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. It's an expediency. It's a convenience. Totally fine. But on the other hand, if somebody said, you know what, I think we should change, and they offer an idea that is in contradiction to scriptures, that goes against what God has said, now is it okay? It no longer becomes convenient if it contradicts God's law. And so that's what Jethro is saying to him here. He's saying, look, this is what I think is a good idea, but not if God says no. Not if it is opposite of what God is hoping for you to do. And so that is a good principle to apply across the board. In the end, verse 24, Moses will listen to his father-in-law, and he did all that he had said, which tells you, by implication, right? Since he listened to his father-in-law and did that, what does it tell you about God's feelings about it? God thought it was a good idea too. And that became the beginning of the Jewish nation using judges throughout the land. Anybody have any comments or questions there before we move forward? Okay, then we move down to chapter 19. One other thing I might mention in chapter 18 before we move to 19 is the men who were to judge were not supposed to judge off their own opinion. When he set these judges, he says that the first thing you were to do in verse 20 is teach them the statutes and the laws. That is, let the people learn God's laws and then they'll be equipped to judge. Right? It's not, hey, they're just wise men and let them do as they please. It's let them know God's laws first. So then chapter 19, we move into in the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt. So quite a bit of time's passed, 3 months, right? They've been out there in the wilderness. On that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And when they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Now, the mountain that they're referring to is Mount Sinai. It is the same mountain that Moses had seen the burning bush. It's the same mountain where God said, "When this will be the sign to you that I am with you, Moses, is at this very spot where I met with you at the burning bush, you'll bring all of the people back, and they will all be here at this mountain." So now, after 3 months of being exiting Egypt, they're now here. Now, on the map here, Let's use technology properly, Scott. There we go. Okay. This is Egypt right up here. This right here is what is traditionally viewed as the Red Sea that the Israelites walked through on dry ground. Now, I will mention the non-traditional view as well, but traditionally this is considered that section. And then that also means then that this area right here, that little, you know, upside down triangle, down there at the bottom, right near where it says Sharm el-Sheikh, is the traditional location of Mount Sinai. Now, there is a non-traditional view, which says that they left the land, and instead of going south down here and crossing the Red Sea and ending up there, they went over the top, and this actually was the Red Sea that was parted, and Mount Sinai is over here. That's the non-traditional view. The fact that there's a traditional view and a non-traditional view tells you, do we know where Mount Sinai is? No. No, people got some guesses. That's just fine. It's not bad to guess, but we should also recognize that that is exactly what it is. It is a guess. So the majority view is that Mount Sinai is in that little triangular V there. And the traditional spot that people think it is this mountain. Now, I show you this not because I want you to go, ooh, that's the mountain, but to give you a mental image of when we talk about Moses going up Mount Sinai, I want you to kind of think of it as being either this mountain or a mountain of similar type. In the same way that when you look at mountains in the Pacific Northwest, they are different. But they're also kind of the same, right? They have a certain Pacific Northwest look to them. So too, if this isn't the mountain, it gives you an idea of the kind of mountain that it would have likely been. Here's another view kind of showing a little bit more of like the land that the Israelites would have gathered around, because they would have surrounded this mountain. Once again, we're talking about a large amount of people. So when you think about them coming to the mountain, they're all at the base, and then it's going to be described the way that the mountain is and the things that are going on that would have been really visually impacting for the Israelites. So they come here to the front of the mountain, in verse 3, it says, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. That's a phrase, that I bore you on eagle's wings, is used a lot in the Psalms. If you've ever tried to visualize your mind, what does God mean when he says, I bore you on eagle's wings? Well, here he describes taking the Israelites from Egypt out here to the mountain. Was he said, I bore you on eagle's wings. Well, was there any eagle involved? It's entirely figurative language. But on the other hand, when you think about it, it's figurative language that makes a lot of sense. You have an eagle that's up in the sky, and no matter what you want to do to him, you're powerless to stop him, right? I remember that I saw a YouTube video once of a little kid, and he had a little pet hamster, and he was showing it off for the very first time, and he had it on a picnic table, and he let the little pet hamster out of the cage, and then the very next thing you saw is, and there was an eagle, and it came, and it took little Johnny's hamster right in front of him and went off with it. And Dad, who's holding the camera, does exactly what Dads do. He laughs and keeps videotaping. But you think about it. Well, the moment that that eagle grabbed the hamster, what are you going to do? Game over, right? There's no, I'm going to save him. There's, let's go back to the pet shop. That's what you're left with. When God said, I'm going to take the Israelites and take him out of Egypt, what could man do to stop that plan? I bore them on eagle's wings. And so when you read through the Psalms and you see that kind of language talked about how God will take care of his people and deliver them, not just Jews, but all the faithful, which would include you and I, just think, when God says he'll take care of you, nobody can stop it. Like an eagle carrying off, you are borne away from whatever he wishes to take you from. Then he tells them, he says, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. As a Christian, you probably heard that phrase somewhere. Where have you heard, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation? Everybody know? It's going to be Peter, that's right, over in 1 Peter. We're told the same thing. We're to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That is, they're the shadow of the greater kingdom, which is us. So God pulls them out to the wilderness. He says, I'm going to give you some laws, because that's what's going to happen here at the mountain. I'm going to give you some standards for how to live so that you can be in all the world the people who represent me to all other people as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This imagery here should tell you and I what we're supposed to be as his people today in the church. We as Christians are to be people who have been given a set of laws and standards and guidance by God, so that we would be people of great faith and commitment, so that in this world, when the world wants to know about God, they would know they could look to us for answers, and that we would be prepared to teach them about the King. And so he says, these are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. And so verse 7, Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do. Is that true? No. Did they think it was true at the time? Probably. But just like in the New Testament, we're told, don't just be a hearer but a doer, right? Them saying, we will do it. Talk is cheap. And so they say, yeah, we'll do it. So Moses brought back the words of the people of the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud so the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. And Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord also said to Moses, go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for the people around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments, and he said to the people, be ready for the third day, do not go near a woman. So it came about on the third day when it was morning that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. So all of this is laid out. There, the people are to come near, but not too near. Near enough to see, but far enough so that they don't die. And they put essentially a quarantine, a border around it, saying, don't come near, don't even let any of your animals come near. Everybody be ready. And everything about their first real encounter with God here is terrifying. Now, God does things for a reason. He has shown that he can save them already. He pulled them out of Egypt. But now, he wants them to see something else about his character that they've not seen. Because up until this point, the plagues have not been affecting them. They've been affecting their enemies. But what's the lesson here? Why would God ever appear in this fashion to them? What's the value to that? That's it. Fear of God is beginning wisdom, right? You can't even begin to understand what living a right life is until you understand that you respect God as the creator of heaven and earth. And so here, fear God and keep his commandments. That's man's all. That's what Solomon will eventually say. And so the people, they trembled at the sound of it and seeing the whole mountain quaking and the thunder and all those things. And so verse 20 says, the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. And the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord spoke to Moses, go down, warn the people so that they do not break through the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set the bounds about the mountain and consecrate it. The Lord said to him, go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them. So Moses went down to the people and told them. Now, all of these events that we just read about are mentioned again over in Hebrews chapter 12. So if you turn in your Bible over to Hebrews 12, one of the goals of this class is to make Old Testament and New Testament connections. And so Hebrews chapter 12, you get down to verse 18, and he says, for you, that is us as Christians, have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words which sound was such that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling. So that's what we're reading back in Exodus. That's what the Hebrew writer is referencing. He says, you've not come to that kind of mountain. He says, but you have come to Mount Zion and the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Now, here's his point. They had a physical mountain, and it was physically terrifying, and they were scared to come even close. We, on the other hand, we don't have a physical mountain that we go to, but should we be more or less fearful? Right? His answer is, you've come to the heavenly. You come to myriads of angels. You come to the place where God doesn't just deal with the bodies of men, but the souls of men. The God, the judge of all. And so you lay all of those things out, and what you have is this picture that if we would be scared back then, and I have no doubt that all of us would be, Hebrews tells us that we as Christians today should both be excited because we are coming to God who makes just men perfect, but also very, very wary. And don't get in your mind that he's not still God, and he's not still powerful, and that he's not still judge of all. So there's an impact there when we kind of connect those two ideas. Does anybody have any comments or questions before we close out? Okay, then we'll stop there. We'll pick up in chapter 20, where we will get the commandments from God.